What are we fighting for? To make our soldiers the best informed in the world, the War Department for the past several months has been presenting discussions before the troops of all our army posts of the nation's best-known commentators. In them, the causes, issues, and strategies of the war are brought before the men of our army. Each Thursday at this time, the Columbia Network visits one of these army posts to pick up one of these talks and to broadcast it to other army posts, both in this country and overseas. Tonight, we are at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, before 1,000 officers and men. To introduce tonight's speaker, we now present the post commander, Brigadier General George L. Van Dusen.
Officers and men of Fort Monmouth, and those listening by radio at other Army stations in the United States and overseas, today we are to hear an internationally famous writer and foreign correspondent who has spent much of his time in the countries of which he is about to speak, the countries of our allies. As special writer for Collier's Magazine, his articles in the last 2 years have revealed not only the strategy of war in Britain, Russia, and Africa, but also the manner in which our allies have dared death that freedom might live. So it is most fitting that he should speak to us of our allies, your comrades in arms. It is my pleasure to welcome to Fort Monmouth Mr. Quentin Reynolds.
Thank you, sir. I've spent most of the past 2 years in England, in Russia, in Libya, and I'm returning to the war zone within a week or so. During the past 2 months, I've been bouncing around this country, spending a lot of time in factories which make war material, spending a lot of time with the men in charge of civilian defense. During that time, I've been asked a lot of questions about your comrades in arms. What kind of fighters are they? Can they take it? Can they give it? I've been asked a lot of questions about the Russian army and about the Russian people. Maybe you fellows have some of the same questions in mind. During the past few years, the Nazi propaganda in our country has been very effective. Congressmen, senators running for office who had no other issue on which to stand would dig deeply into the political grab bag and come up with that old political chestnut, "Beware of the Red Menace." Consciously or unconsciously, they worked hand in hand with the Nazi propagandists. And we, like dumb sheep, believed half the lies we heard about Russia. I was there last fall. It took me about a week to find out that the Russians are our kind of people. It took me about a month to realize that they had absolutely no interest in overthrowing our kind of government, and that they had no sympathy with American communists who were of that mind. In fact, I found out that the Russians were greatly embarrassed by American communists who gave them such a bad name. All the Russians wanted was to be left alone. That's all they want now. When the war is over, they'll keep on with their form of government, communism, but they don't care whether any other country adopts it. People ask me, can we trust the Russians? I think close to 2 million of them who have fallen in battle have proven that the Russians can be trusted until the death. I sometimes wonder when people ask me that, whether or not the Russians can trust us. I met a Russian captain who was on leave from the front while I was in Moscow. He talked English and we became very friendly. One night I was sitting with him and with an English correspondent. We had a few drinks of vodka, and as happens when you have a few drinks of vodka, you get to doing a lot of talking. We started making plans for after the war. What kind of a world would it be after we've licked the Germans and the Japs? The British correspondent and I had all sorts of plans. The Germans would have to be kept in check so we wouldn't have to go through all this mess again. But how to keep them in check? That was the question. Oh, we had plenty of ideas, none of them very good. Then our Russian captain said quietly, We in the Red Army have a plan. After we have chased the Germans out of our country, we'll keep right on and chase them back to Berlin. Then you British keep out of it for a month or so. You Americans keep out of it, too, for a little while. Just let us be the army of occupation for a month, and things will adjust themselves. Yes, we can trust the Russians, all right. The Russians are filled with hatred for the Nazi army, which completely devastated the Ukraine and southern and central Russia. Hatred is a good, healthy emotion. Countries which don't hate tyranny enough have proven easy victims for Hitler. Belgium, Holland, Norway, France, they didn't hate fascism enough. The Russians do, and they're proving it. Remember, the Russians aren't fighting for communism. The Russians are fighting for Russia. Believe me, they're our kind of people. And sooner or later, when you get to the front with them, fighting at your side, you'll realize it. In a fight, a Russian is a good man to have along. In my tour around this country, a lot of people asked me about the British. I was amazed to find that a lot of people thought that the British weren't doing much fighting on their own, that they were letting the Canadians and South Africans, New Zealanders and Australians do it for them. I think that this sort of talk sprang from that master propagandist of the radio, Lord Haw-Haw. He's been harping on it for months, and a lot of our countrymen have believed him. I've seen the British fight. I saw the British civilians fight back in London, in Plymouth, in Coventry, in Southampton. I saw bombs destroy their homes, kill their children, wound and maim half the population of cities. But I never heard one Britisher say, "Let's quit." I've been with the British Navy running the gauntlet of the English or British Channel, slipping through the submarine-infested waters of the North Atlantic. I've been out on their trawlers, mine-sweeping, and I've been with them in the desert. Only 3 months ago, I was with a British regiment, the 1st Royal Sussex. It was just an ordinary line regiment. It had orders to capture a place called Sidi Omar, south of Tobruk. Sidi Omar was nothing but a one-mile raised plateau in the desert, heavily held by Germans and Italians. To make things tougher, the Germans had surrounded the plateau with a minefield. You know there are always gaps in a minefield through which tanks and men can pass safely, if you can find the gaps. But these tough men of the 1st Royal Sussex, most of them farmers or the sons of farmers, were in too much of a hurry to look for any gaps. They busted right through the barbed wire, they and their tanks. They rushed through the minefields, although 100 machine guns were trained on them, mowing them down. You know about those mines. They're buried maybe 10 inches below the sand, and the tread of a man's foot will explode them. These British soldiers I was with knew that, but they yelled to hell with the mines and broke through. It was pretty horrible. 10 tanks blew up, but the men rushing behind the tanks didn't stop. They wanted to get in close with that steel. Some of them did. Hundreds didn't. But those crazy men who were so filled with the healthy emotion of hatred toward our common enemy kept on. And once they were in close, it was a beautiful sight. It was a beautiful sight if you hate Germans as I hate Germans. It was a beautiful sight to one who had been on the defensive for 2 years, taking it all the time, to see these British soldiers giving it. They didn't show much mercy. When the smoke cleared and we were in complete possession of the plateau, the Germans made a counterattack, a nasty one. They came with 24 tanks and with their dive bombers. They gave us plenty of hell for a while, but those British soldiers are bulldogs. They held on. For 3 days and 3 nights they gave it to us, and then reinforcements came and we were all right. I told the colonel in command that I'd been on lots of fronts, but never in my life had I seen men fight like this. It was the greatest exhibition of courage I'd ever seen. The British colonel smiled and said quietly, I saw men fight like that once before. It was at Chateau Thierry, and the men were United States Marines. Yes, the British are fighting and dying, but the British War Office is much like our War Department. They don't believe much in patting themselves on the back. They don't believe in making public heroes out of men who have no desire to be anything but good soldiers. So the world hasn't learned much about the way the men of Britain fight and die. Only a handful of us correspondents have been privileged to see them in action. They die very well. You can't give higher praise than that to soldiers. The Germans know how to fight. And they know, too, how the British fight. I've talked to lots of German prisoners. They're good soldiers, mind you. After all, they've been trained since birth in this business of murder. They're professionals at it. Their pilots are good, too. But they fear one thing, the British Spitfire. The Spitfire won the Battle of Britain, just as our Curtiss Wright P-40s are winning the Battle of the East. The Germans fear the Spitfires just as the Japs fear our pursuit ships. I went to a hospital in Kent one day to talk to some German prisoners who were there. There were 12 German airmen who'd bailed out over England and were in this ward. A doctor came in and was horrified and angry to find that 11 of these 12 German airmen were covered with black and blue marks. And he turned to the nurse and said angrily, "What's the meaning of this? Have you allowed someone in here to beat these men up?" She said, "Oh, no, doctor, it isn't that at all." He said, "Why are they covered with black and blue marks, then?" She said, "Well, doctor, last night, that 12th German airman was delirious all night. And in his delirium, he kept crying out, 'Spitfire, Spitfire.' And every time he cried out, 'Spitfire,' the other 11 bailed out of bed." Don't sell our allies short. They're fighting men just as you are fighting men. Don't believe the propaganda from the enemies outside our country and from the enemies within our borders. For 2 years, they've tried to tell us that this wasn't our war. For 2 years, they've tried to tell us of the great difference which existed between America and Britain and Russia. But we know better now. We know there's only one fundamental difference between America and Britain and Russia. It's this. Here in America, we drive our cars on the right side of the road. In England, they drive to the left. And anyone who's ever been in Moscow knows those crazy Russians drive right down the middle of the road. But the road to Berlin is a wide one. And there's room enough on it for all three of us. And America can take the right side of the road. And Britain can take the left of the road. And Russia can take the middle of the road. And we'll go swinging along, side by side. No matter how long the road is, or how many detours there may be through the Far East or other places, it won't bother us, because we know that as long as we three trust each other, that road will bring us to Berlin together.
From Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, the War Department and the Columbia Network have broadcast the fourth in a series of talks to American soldiers here and abroad, as part of a comprehensive program by the Army designed to keep our soldiers the best informed in the world. The speaker tonight on this series, titled "What Are We Fighting For?" was Quentin Reynolds, foreign correspondent and associate editor of Collier's Magazine. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.